Some people are just gonna hate you, no matter what you do. So don't waste your time trying to change their minds. Just be a better you. It took me years to learn this, more than I'd like to admit. But through my ups and downs, I figured one thing out. Don't take anyone's shit.
Heard Do One from Frank Taylor, which is taken from his forthcoming 10th studio album, Undefeated. And I'm joined by Frank now to talk about that. Hello, sir. How are we today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you for joining me today. Do One sort of released, that was, I think, the second single from the album. Very much a statement of defiance. And I've read that the album is around survival and defiance and everything. And what can you tell us about Undefeated?
Well, it's my 10th solo album, which is a remarkable thing. It's getting to double figures. It's not something that many bands, artists, whatever, get to do. And on some levels, I'm proud of that. And on other levels, I'm sort of slightly surprised or bamboozled by it. It's like, it's still working. Like, what's going on? So, you know, a lot of the record, it's hopefully a stylistically and thematically diverse piece of writing, but the sort of overarching themes are, you know, coming to terms with the fact that I'm now in my 40s, but still feel like a punk, and I'm still making music, and I'm proud of that, but also quite, where do I fit into everything? So it's a rumination on such things.
Okay, excellent. And I think is it 19 years as a solo artist?
It slightly depends where you start counting from. I count my shows, and show one was in 2004, but I was still in a band called Million Dead at the time. I mean, they broke up in 2005. So yeah, let's say 19 years.
Yeah, so it's sort of in your 40s, and you're getting to that nearly half of your life.
I did my first tour in the summer of 1998, and I rejoice in scaring younger bands by telling them that I toured in the 20th century.
Brilliant. You count your gigs. What number are you up to now?
2,851 or two, I think it is.
Wow.
I've been asked that question before today, which is why I know the answer. Yeah. It's a number that I keep constant in my brain.
Yeah, I mean, I've been lucky enough to see you live a number of times, sort of over the years. And you asked on the, I think the email list recently, you asked people to let you know the first time they saw you and everything. I mean, I'm assuming you've had quite a few fans that have been there from the very beginning.
Yeah, you know, in a way that I'm just sort of so grateful for and pleasantly surprised by, you know. And like, I've been doing this long enough now that of course there's turnover and people who came to shows for a certain period and don't anymore, or you know, liked some of my records and don't like others, whatever it might be. But I do more regularly than I would have imagined. I encounter people who are like, I saw you in 2006, and I'm just like, wow, like, thank you so much for sticking with, you know. What I do has changed and evolved over time, but I still play some early songs, of course.
Yeah.
But I think the thing is that anybody's changed in that period of time. It'd be crazy not to, you know. So I'm sort of trying away from the cliche about having grown up with my audience, but I think that's basically what I'm trying to say.
I mean, I do remember the first time I saw you, which was I went to Cambridge for that one at the Corn Exchange, and was blown away by, you know, at some points the fans were louder than you, and you're not quite a band on stage, but there's few artists I've seen. I can probably on one hand can name the sort of artists that I've seen where the fans are so passionate and will sing back every single word at volume. So.
Sure. I mean, it's a huge privilege, and if I told you I knew why people choose to do that on my shows, I'd be lying. Other than that I join in with that kind of stuff with the bands that I love.
Do you
know what I mean? But it's like, you know, even from early doors, like people sing along's been quite a big part of what I do, and I'm so grateful for it. It feels very communitarian, should we say?
Yeah.
It's always been something that I'm slightly like, wow, how are you doing that? That's awesome.
Yeah, it certainly sounds good when you're in a room and everyone's doing it, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
You've announced a number of sort of UK festivals this year. I think 2000 Trees, Latitude, a very strong hint and not particularly subtle one on Twitter around Glastonbury, and you're doing a few others. I mean, what is it about festivals that you like so much? And Reading has obviously a special place for you as well.
Sure. I mean, lots of things. I mean, from a kind of strictly kind of career business point of view, however you want to put it, like festivals are cool. They're like speed dating as a band. You know what I mean? It's like the audience can see a lot of bands in one day. So you probably don't want to do the kind of like Jazz Odyssey set, but like it's a cool way of making new friends. You know what I mean? And somebody who may not be ready to buy a ticket for your show might give you the time of day and might win them over and happy days. But I think more philosophically than that, like, and speaking as somebody who's often been a punter as well as a musician, like, you know, there's something magic about being at a festival. You know, it feels like you're on a holiday from normal society. And my friend Jay, who makes music as Beans on Toast, wrote a song called This Side of the Fence, which is about all of this and says what I'm trying to say here much better than I can. But, you know, it's like a pleasant holiday from kind of normal awfulness.
Indeed, I must admit, I mean, this will be my 17th Glastonbury in a row this year, so and I work it now with Oxfam, but I've done it for many years as a punter and took my kids, so it's I get exactly what you're saying there. I mean, your own festival, Lost Evenings, this year, Toronto. I mean, have you got a dream list of locations that you want to take Lost Evenings to? Or, I mean, how do you choose each year?
I do, and it should be said that I've sort of made a deal. My production manager, who's the centre of my touring crew, is from Kirby near Liverpool, and he has made me promise that Lost Evenings 27 will be in Kirby if we ever get there. Anyway, I mean, I should say we've got the next couple of years kind of not just planned but like booked. So,
right,
like,
okay.
You know, and it's a big part of my annual diary. And like, I will say that last year was LA, this year's Toronto. I'm aware that's two in the North American landmass in a row, and that the next one will not be on that side of the Atlantic. And that's all I'm going to say. About
okay. That. I wasn't going to go there, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure. But I mean, it started as a bit of a kind of an experiment, a bit of a Hail Mary, should we say. And the first year surprised everybody by going quite well. And people seem to really enjoy it. And then, you know, we built it over the years. So this is number 7 in Canada, and it's a wonderful thing. We're going to, you know, play to 4,000 people a night for 4 nights in Canada, who are coming from Toronto, of course, but from all over Canada and all over the world. And it's a huge privilege. It's the kind of thing I have to like not spend that long thinking about in detail, because I might then disappear up my own fundament. We used to write each other
such beautiful letters. And every time I'd see my name in a handwriting on an envelope, my day would get a bit better. I didn't forget her. How could I ever forget her? But now all that's left on my desk in the dust and neglect is some envelopes empty as ever. It's a terrible thing to share everything that you got with the one person who matters, and have it not really matter. We used to write each other letters. And you were kind of tied up. God only knows I didn't want to impose, so I just bit my tongue with a stiff lip until it was far too late for me to even contemplate writing again just to ask where you've been. So I guess we just settled on stalemate. It's a terrible thing to share everything that you got with the one person who matters, and having not really matter. We used to write each other letters. Muddling through, I need tired of making do. I'm tired of muddling through. It's a terrible thing to share everything that you got with the one person who matters, and have it not really matter. We used to write each other letters, but it's a curious thing to doubt everything that you got and get saved by a stranger you knew when you were younger. I'm gonna write another letter. Try and put it better.
I'm going to admit something to you. You have a habit of making me cry at gigs.
For good reasons.
So at the Clapham Grand, one was the first socially distanced gig during that. and that just got to me. And then again at the Clapham Grand when it was the first, when the world started opening up and the first normal gig there. And then at Lost Evenings 2018, when you lost your friend Scott Hutchinson, and you've been very, very open over the last few years, both on stage, in interviews, and in your lyrics around, I mean, your struggles with mental health and that kind of thing. Do you think that the stigma around opening up and being sort of more free to talk about mental health issues is it getting better?
It's definitely getting better. It's important to say that doesn't mean that the job is done and therefore move on. But if I think about if I think about the idea of talking about mental health in an interview in 2003, the way that I do in 2023, it just wouldn't ever have happened back then. And if you go back even further, one of the things that I found interesting thinking about recently was in all the anniversaries of the passing of Kurt Cobain, like at the time of his death, people didn't really, it was just like, oh yeah, well, he shot himself. Like there wasn't really a discussion around mental health and suicide, like at all. And one of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah, that's bizarre,
like,
isn't it?
Shot himself in the head. Yeah. And like nobody talked about mental health. And it was just like, and obviously now it would be a radically different and better situation. So I think clearly I'm speaking within my own universe of the music world or whatever, but clearly the direction of travel is the right one. Of course, that's not to say that the job is done, or whatever. And my role in this conversation, such as it is a kind of pathfindery, shall we say. Yeah. I mean, I went through a long period of time being like violently skeptical of the effect that musicians could have on the world. Partly because that's slightly kind of like, get into the Greek character who's kind of like, you know, doing the Bono sort of rip-off thing. Indeed going to see crust bands telling me they're going to destroy capitalism with the next 2 minutes of music, and it's like, you're probably not.
Yeah.
But I had the fortune of seeing Stephen Fry speak, and he was talking about gay rights, and he was talking about the way that sort of people like Elton John and Freddie Mercury and the rest, and Tom Robinson before them, kind of blazed a path for a change in social attitudes. And it was very powerful the way that he talked about it. So I do, that's the, limited as it is, that's the role that people like me can play, as if in having this conversation.
Smooth
path forward.
And I think you, and I remember when Stormzy came out around his, it's a platform that not everyone's got. And I think people do listen. Listen to musicians around that. It's an interesting concept, but it definitely, I think, is doing some good without a shadow of a doubt. Another thing, Giggs and you did a huge amount of work during the pandemic for the Music Venue Trust and Grassroots Venue. And you did a couple of nights at the Hotbox in Chelmsford, just down the road from us, to help them and everything. What's your situation and your take on where we are? Because it doesn't feel like we've gone back to where we need to be to keep these venues going.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think that, first of all, as in so many walks of life, the pandemic in some ways revealed problems that were lurking maybe a little faster than they might otherwise have come to the fore, but like they didn't necessarily cause every problem, they just sort of revealed them, if you see what I mean. But secondly, like, I mean, you know, the fact that the news cycle's moved on, like you have a news story about, like, you know, everybody in the live music sector has kind of lost their financial security, their cushion, and their insurance, I might add, and, you know, huge swathes of staff have left and all this kind of thing. And then it's like 24 hours later, we're talking about something else. It's kind of like, well, that story didn't just end.
No.
Because of that.
Something needs to happen about it, yeah.
Right. And you know, God bless Mark and the Music Venue Trust, because they do just such an incredible job. And I who knows how much worse things would be without them being where they are. And they're talking about doing the kind of £1 venue levy thing at arena shows, which I think is really cool. And interestingly, something they already do in France. So, you know, it's doable. So, you know, there are good people working on this, and I try and sort of throw in as and when I can. I've got a thing that I'm announcing next week, which is relevant to this conversation. he said, remaining circumspect. But it's not a particularly rosy time in the independent venue sector.
Okay. I'm very aware of the time. So hopefully I've got time for one last question. Yeah. I wanted to ask how this
good
came
Lord,
about.
Look at that.
So 10 Tragedies. It's a book with some incredible writers in, and your first foray into fiction, I believe. I mean, how did this come about?
Well, it's my first published foray into fiction.
Right. Yeah.
So basically, I wrote a song called Mittens that was about it was about lots of things, but it was sort of predicated on a story of finding a bunch of old postcards in a store in New York, which is a true story. And Christopher Golden and Tim Levin, who are two wonderful authors, got in touch with me and sort of they said, we love that song. They were like, is the bit about the postcards true? And I was like, yes, I have them. I bought a huge crate of old postcards from a thrift store in Brooklyn and shipped them home. And they suggested this idea of sending out postcards to different writers and getting people to write a short story based around that postcard. And I said, oh, that's a wonderful and flattering to my song idea. Fantastic. Yeah. Have my blessing and off you go. And they said, come on, man, you should do one. And I was like, I wrote some short stories when I was a teenager. I don't think I really did. But I'm pretty impressed that you have a copy there. And I did my level best to write a decent short story, but who knows?
Yeah, I will hold my hands up and I haven't read it yet, but I'm a big fan of pretty much a library downstairs, but
what you would say if you'd read it and hadn't enjoyed it.
Right? Yeah, no. It's on my list. But I'm a big Tim LeBon is. I've followed him from the very beginning, so I'm a big fan of his work.
Lovely
so,
guy, great writer. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
I stumbled on a thrift store that sold postcards by the yard. I bought a mile and shipped them home so I could read 10,000 10-word tragedies, the lives these strangers lead. To remind myself the things I need. I once wrote you love songs. You never fell in love. We used to fit like mittens, but never like gloves. You left me feeling like we'd never really been in love. Huddled homebound in my place in Holloway, I wondered if you even heard those songs I used to play. I wrote them as a gift for you, and in return
was me chatting to Frank Turner at the tail end of the last week. It didn't actually end quite so abruptly, but I started babbling like an idiot, so I thought I'd cut myself off before I sounded even more stupid than I normally do on the radio. Started off before the interview would do one, then latest single Letters, and then we heard Mittens, which we spoke about, the book, and you can still find that book knocking around if that sounds of interest to you. The thing that Frank mentioned that he couldn't quite talk about yet to help the Music Venue Trust has been announced now. He's undertaking trying to get the world record for the most gigs played in 24 hours on May the 4th and May the 5th in support of grassroots music venues. This is quite an impressive thing that he's doing here. So he's starting off at 12:30 at lunchtime in Liverpool, before doing Huddersfield, Leeds, Sheffield, Chesterfield, Nottingham, Birmingham, Leamington Spa, Leighton Buzzard, London, The Underworld, Kingston, Banquet Records, Aldershot, Portsmouth, Winchester, finishing off in Southampton at midnight on Sunday the 5th of May. So lots of travelling.
Lots of gigs at Silly O'Clock. So the London Underworld gig is at 4 a.m. and then he's doing Banquet Records in Kingston at 6 a.m. if you are a fan and want to go and see him in London on a Sunday morning. Not quite sure how you're going to get there. These are things to be overcome. He's being provided with free taxis to help him buy the company free now. There's a 500-mile journey from Liverpool to Southampton that he's doing from, as I said, starting at lunchtime on the Saturday, and 500 miles later finishing at the end of Sunday. Quite incredible what Frank is doing. And he continues his amazing support of grassroots venues. It was a very quick chat to Frank. I hope to have more time with him. I had loads of questions that I could have asked, and it was a little bit rushed, but he was a delight to talk to, so thank you very much to Mr. Turner.